The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and I hope you're having an enjoyable and relaxing Labor Day weekend. With the struggles that newspapers have had in recent years, one of the areas that they've had to cut back on has been investigative reporting. That gave rise to an organization called ProPublica. And this evening, you will get to meet their president, Richard Toefel, who will tell us exactly what they do.
So ProPublica, as you suggest, is a nonprofit investigative journalism newsroom. We print, publish everything on our own website at ProPublica.org, but we also work with leading journalism organizations in partnership. And as you say, we've been publishing now for a little bit more than 9 years. We focus on investigative journalism in the hopes that it is a critical part of democratic governance in our society, revealing to people things that people in power don't want them to know, that we hope that will make them more effective citizens.
And there is a relatively modest family foundation in Minnesota, the GHR Foundation, which has made big news lately with something called the Bridge Builder Challenge. And we will be joined by their CEO, Amy Goldman.
And we clearly were inspired by Pope Francis as well, calling globally to build bridges across areas. We found that very powerful. So, Denver, as we were thinking about what are we going to do with this legacy grant to perhaps respond to that call of Pope Francis, while at the same time thinking about how can we open the windows at our foundation and let some fresh air in? How can we find out what those good ideas are out there? We started to think about creating a challenge.
And we'll round out the hour with a Better Than Most Corporate Culture segment, as well as a Take 5 lightning round. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, September 3rd. Newman's Own recently celebrated its 35th anniversary. It was August 25th, 1982, when they shipped their first bottles of salad dressing. Their giving over those years is close to $500 million, benefiting more than 7,500 charities in 75-plus countries. The opioid addiction crisis is having a devastating impact on rural communities, where older people are especially vulnerable to becoming collateral damage. The Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation said it plans to spend $152 million over the next 7 years to protect the ecology of North American oceans. Hiring by charities remains strong, according to a new study by nonprofit HR, but most groups lack recruitment strategies, hampering their ability to draw top-flight talent in a tight labor market. In spite of reduced rates of uninsured patients, nonprofit hospitals have seen a decrease in profit margin over the last year, this according to new data from Moody's Investor Services. When Whirlpool first donated washers and dryers to low-income schools, chronically absent kids started showing up an average of 2 more days per month. They now hope a new partnership with Teach for America will expand that program's reach even further. In the wake of Hurricane Harvey, many of us think about using our cell phones as a way to text a contribution to a charity to support disaster relief. But cell phones can also be used to reach donors in connection with mobile advocacy campaigns. And Rebecca Koenig of the Chronicle Philanthropy wrote about one such example this week. Becky, it was Food and Water Watch. Who are they?
Thanks for having me. Food and Water Watch is a nonprofit that focuses on corporate and government accountability relating to food and environmental issues. So they are often interested in pressuring local leaders and national leaders to promote policies that fit their mission.
You know, a question I have for you is, how does an organization like this go about building that list of cell phone numbers in order to be able to text people?
One reason Food and Water Watch thinks its text-based advocacy is so useful is because people opt in to receive their text messages. So supporters have to text a short code to a number that Food and Water Watch provides, and then they'll be subscribed to their texting list. So they hope that they're really getting people who care about their issues, who are volunteering their information.
Got it. Well, one of their more effective efforts have been call-in days. What are those? And give us an example of one.
A call-in day is when an organization asks its supporters to call certain officials who are considering legislation that affects an issue that the organization cares about. So Food and Water Watch uses its mobile phone list to ask its donors and its supporters to call their legislators when an issue is on the table. So one example that happened pretty recently is Food and Water Watch was hoping to ban fracking in Maryland. And so staff members texted all the supporters on the local Maryland lists and asked them to call their legislators in Maryland. And they got more than 700 phone calls just from those text messages. And they hope that that helped contribute to the fact that the state did ban fracking.
Yeah, and they're able to track those phone calls with the way they do their texts. They also seek supporter feedback. Talk to that.
Yes. So text messages are a pretty intimate form of communication, and they have gotten a lot of great messages back from people who subscribe to their list. And to take advantage of this, they have asked people to kind of text them pictures and messages that they can use on their social media platforms, just the way you might text a selfie of yourself to a friend.
Yeah.
Food and Water Watch wants you to text those kinds of personal pictures to them so that they can use those to kind of spread the word about what they are hoping to support.
A wonderful way to build a community. Let me close with this. Were there any overall recommendations from the folks at Food and Water Watch about texting supporters during an advocacy campaign?
Yes. There are three things that they recommend other organizations keep in mind. It's important to make sure you coordinate your text messages with all of your other forms of communication. So whatever you're sending via text should be similar to what you send via email and also what you post on Facebook. That way people are seeing the same message. It's also helpful to appoint specific staff members to respond to the questions you're going to get back from people via text. So if you know you're texting 500 people that day, you need to make sure you have enough volunteers or staff members on hand to reply. And then, because we are all pretty attached to our phones, Food and Water Watch recommends being judicious about how frequently you use mobile call lists. If you start texting people, you know, too often, they're going to get very frustrated.
Oh, yeah.
And feel a little invaded. So it's important to choose carefully what messages you send and when you send them.
Well, all good advice. Thanks so much for this report, Becky.
Thank you.
I'll be back to speak with Richard Toefel, the president of ProPublica, right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Youth opportunities, strong communities, a healthy planet. Sounds like the work of social entrepreneurs. Yes, but it's also the work of artists. Upstart CoLab is a new national collaboration connecting artists, impact investors, and social entrepreneurs. Upstart's mission is to create opportunities for artist innovators to deliver social impact at scale. Upstart is committed to promoting artists as innovators, unleashing capital for creativity, and enabling sustainable creative lives. Find out more at www.upstartco-lab.org. Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
There have been few industries that have been disrupted any more in recent years than have newspapers and magazines. And as they fight to survive by cutting costs, one of the areas that many have jettisoned has been investigative reporting. And that's not good for any of us. So what was needed was a new business model, a nonprofit one, to help carry on this work. And this is how ProPublica came into existence back in 2007. And with us this evening is the president of ProPublica, Richard Toefel. Good evening, Dick, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Denver, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about ProPublica and the mission and goals of the organization.
So ProPublica, as you suggest, is a nonprofit investigative journalism newsroom. We print, publish everything on our own website at ProPublica.org, but we also work with leading journalism organizations in partnership. And as you say, we've been publishing now for a little bit more than 9 years. We focus on investigative journalism in the hopes that it is a critical part of democratic governance in our society, revealing to people things that people in power don't want them to know that we hope that will make them more effective citizens.
Well, you have had a really sensational first decade of existence. How has your audience grown, and how has the organization been recognized for some of its outstanding work?
We've been very fortunate. We're now reaching directly on our site somewhere between somewhere between 2 and 3 million people visiting us in an average month.
That's impressive.
Between 4 and 5 million pages of our material read on our own site. And then, of course, there's the material being read when the stories are published by our partners. We've had 149 journalistic partners, pretty much every leading news organization in the country. And in terms of recognition, thank you for asking. We've been fortunate enough to win 4 Pulitzer Prizes. I think literally half of the Pulitzer Prizes awarded to digital journalism organizations so far.
Congratulations. Well, you know, since the presidential campaign, Dick, last year, I know more people dialed in and following the news than I ever have in my life. What has the impact of the Trump presidency been on your operations?
It's been very, very significant. Traffic is up 40, 50, 60% 1 or 2 months, over 70% this year over the previous year. Funding has been up enormously. So just to, without drowning people in numbers, we had 3,400 donors in total in 2015. We had 26,000 in 2016. And so far this year, although most of that kind of activity occurs, or much of it occurs at the end of a year,
sure.
So far in 2017, we've had more than 21,000 donors.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, let's talk about trust in the media a little bit, something that the president talks a lot about, actually not trusting the media. You know, it's at an all-time low, but I would say that trust for almost all of our institutions are at an all-time low. You have said that many people very well may not trust the media, but they believe it. Share with us what you mean by that.
So here's what I mean about that. I certainly wouldn't dispute the surveys about low trust in the media. And as you say, I think that extends across almost all of our institutions. But and my favorite example of this are the president's approval ratings.
Mm-hmm.
The president's approval ratings, as folks probably know, are the worst of any new president in our history.
Right.
Already, after just 200 days, the president's low point in approval is lower than 7 of his 10 predecessors ever were across 42 years between them of occupying the presidency. So the question is, where are they getting the basis for the conclusion? So many people, a very substantial majority of the American people, that they don't approve of the president's performance in office. And I think the answer is they're getting it from what's being reported in the news media.
Mm-hmm.
I think, frankly, that's why the president is so frustrated. He's frustrated because he's not getting a lot done. He's not delivering on his promises. And the press is telling the American people that that is the case.
So whereas people may say, I don't trust the media, somehow it's having an impact in the responses to how's the president doing.
Yeah. And I think more generally, it's not obviously just about the president. There's a little bit of a phenomenon here that is analogous to the phenomenon about the Congress. You know, the old saw about the Congress is that nobody likes the Congress. I think the approval rating of the Congress as a whole is literally about 10%.
That's right.
It's well below the media. But most people actually approve of their own member of Congress.
And funny how that works.
Yeah. And the overwhelming majority of members of Congress are reelected when they stand for reelection. So there's a little bit of a similar thing going on where people, I think, don't trust the media in general, but do trust implicitly or even explicitly the sources they choose to get their news from themselves.
Right. I touched a little bit about this in the opening, but give us a fuller explanation as to why commercial outlets, journals, have cut back so dramatically on investigative reporting.
The shortest answer is because it's very expensive. And it's very expensive, I would guess, for three reasons. First, it can take a great deal of time to do well. Second, a certain amount of it is like wildcatting for oil. And there are a bunch of dry holes.
Yeah.
You see a story that you think is going to be a great investigative story, and you spend a week or sometimes a month or 2 months on it, and you discover that there isn't. And then if you're principled, you walk away. And so that's very expensive. And the third is it's relatively, even relative to other kinds of journalism, high skill work. So it's not the kind of thing in general that people do at the earliest part of their career, and therefore the people who do it tend to make somewhat more on the average than the average journalistic practitioner. So all of those things lead you in the same direction, which is its high cost. And so as the media business has been squeezed, particularly starting in 2005, really the state of the media business as a business has been downhill literally every quarter since 2005. One of the things that is being squeezed down and out in many places is investigative reporting.
Yeah. Well, with this dearth of investigative reporting, there are so many issues that you could put a microscope under and investigate, probably too many to count. So take us inside your newsroom and share with us the process for deciding what stories to pursue and the factors that you take under consideration.
So it's a little bit easier for us, actually, to do this than many. We're a nonprofit, so we are a mission-based organization, and our mission, very expressly in our mission statement, is to spur reform through journalistic means, to spur change in the real world. So that is the screen through which we look at potential stories. We want to do stories that nobody else is doing, because if they're all doing them, they don't need us. And we want to do stories that can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're on stories that we think we're beginning to make progress or that show some potential, we pursue them. So that is really the key analysis that our editors go through in committing the scarce resource that we have, which is our reporter's talent, to a story.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about trying to create change. And I want to ask you that in the context of time. There was a story in the September Harvard Business Review, and it was a new report that just came out from the Bridgman Group. And it asserted that large-scale social impact requires decades. So what they did is they took a look at anti-apartheid and marriage equality and school lunches and tobacco control, and they found that 90% of those issues took 20 years or more, with a median of about 45 years. So when you're doing your investigative reporting and want to have that kind of impact, how do you think about time and those changes that you're trying to create in the concept of these longer-term, larger-scale change?
So sometimes we do stories about things that are going to take 20 years, but very frankly, frequently we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do, I would say that we are more chipping away at some smaller aspect of a larger problem. So you could frame the work we're doing more broadly to fit into that, but we tend to deal with specifics. Journalism, particularly investigative journalism, is about facts.
Yep.
And so we'll look at something like, for instance, our fourth Pulitzer earlier this year, which we won with the New York Daily News, was about the abuse of nuisance abatement orders by the New York City Police Department. And we got those practices reformed. That took less than a year. You could frame that as part of a different kind of relationship between people and local police. You could frame it as part of a broader real estate trends or housing trends. But it is in the specifics where the real potential of investigative reporting in the shorter run comes. I think it's also important to remember we are doing daily journalism. We are doing digital journalism. We're not writing books, right? We're not. There are very important work that's been done like that. So Michael Harrington's The Other America, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Mm-hmm.
Investigative journalism is – daily journalism is very rarely like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, another story that you did that caught my attention and others in the nonprofit sector was a story you did on the Red Cross in Haiti, which I think you did in partnership with NPR. For those who may have missed this, tell us about that story.
So the – headline of that story is something like, I'm paraphrasing, the Red Cross spent millions in Haiti and built only 6 homes.
Right.
And that is the heart of the story. Unfortunately, I mean, the Red Cross has a wonderful mission and they've done some very distinguished things in their history. But we reported with NPR, as you say, about the management of the Red Cross for a couple of years. And we discovered a very, very disappointing and disturbing pattern of, frankly, poor management, poor results, waste of money, internal complaints that were not being answered, an excessively corporate approach, I think, to what is ultimately supposed to be one of the nation's largest charities. We didn't, frankly, have as much impact there as we had hoped we would. I think my analysis, I can't prove this, is that part of the problem at the Red Cross is that the board is at least as entrenched as management. and that a bunch of the problems have been at the board level. But we do try to take on all sorts of power centers. This is really the broadest lesson of this. We write about politics and government. We write about business. Those are the two usual suspects in, when it comes to investigative reporting in this country, and we do that. But we're also willing to look at any other power centers that we think are either abusing their power or failing to live up to the public trust. And unfortunately, I think if you look at the American Red Cross, in many ways, in many cases, it is one of them.
Well, you mentioned you didn't quite have the impact there that you would hope. Give us a story that you really have had tremendous impact on.
Well, so very close to the beginning of ProPublica, we wrote a story about the regulation of oversight of nursing in the state of California, which was a disaster. And we published it in partnership with the Los Angeles Times on a Sunday. And at that time, Schwarzenegger was the governor of California. And one of the virtues, I think, of having an action hero as a political leader is he walked into the office, as we understand it, the next day, brandishing a copy of the LA Times and saying, I want to fix this and I want to fix it today. And we are told he was, as the story goes, that he was told by some of his aides that he couldn't because he had appointed most of the members of the governing nursing board. And again, being the action hero that he was, he said he really didn't care who had appointed them, and he fired them that afternoon. You know, investigative journalism is rarely like that.
I would imagine.
That you have the revolution in one day. But we've had substantial impact, I'm glad to say, in a lot of areas. We report about this publicly to stakeholders 3 times a year, and all those reports are available on our own website. So we'll be putting out the second of our reports for this year in early September.
Right, January, May, and September.
Exactly, and we'll be enumerating the specific results of our reporting then as we do every 4 months.
You recently launched the Documenting Hate News Index. How does that work?
So this is part of a larger effort that we've been engaged in all year, our project on documenting hate. And it's trying to do a number of things. It's basically a coalition of news organizations, about 100 of them now, that are asking people to tell us their stories of hate crimes and bias incidents, trying to facilitate local reporting around the country on that subject, trying to get a better handle on the data on hate crimes and see if we can get it, more of it understood, reported, and a better handle on the data. The News Index, which we've now made public in partnership with Google News, isolates all the news about hate crimes and bias incidents. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of it, and makes it easily searchable and therefore particularly available to local reporters around the country who can write about it for their own community.
You get your stories out, aside from your website, which is growing in popularity, as we discussed, through your partners and your distribution partners. And boy, do you have a lot of them. Tell us about them and how these partnerships work.
Thank you. They work in a variety of ways. First of all, who they are. They're pretty much every leading news organization in the country: the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR News, television, magazines, radio, online. We select our partners to the extent we can with an eye to maximizing the impact of the story, to increasing the chances that we can spur change. Sometimes we jointly report with other news organizations.
Mm-hmm.
As we did, for instance, in the case of the Red Cross stories that you mentioned, and this year with NPR, that same partner, we're doing a major project on maternal mortality, for which the rates are actually rising in this country, unique among the industrialized world. Sometimes we do the reporting alone, and our partners publish it jointly with us. So it varies quite a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, I would think initially that if you really want to have an impact on an issue, you want to go to those big partners like the Washington Post and the New York Times and NPR. But sometimes you also look for those niche publications that will target a specific audience. Give us an example where that's been the case.
So it's been enormously effective. I mean, a couple of examples would be the Chronicle of Higher Education in the education field, where I think we spurred real change in the Social Security disability process.
You absolutely did.
Where there was an enormous amount of money being wasted by the government having parallel processes in different agencies. And another area where we spurred real change was with the help of our partners at Stars and Stripes, the military publication, where we looked at brain injury among the troops, which was a serious problem. And we had been reporting that again with NPR and ourselves, and frankly, not getting very far. Mm-hmm. And when we brought Stars and Stripes into the mix, the Joint Chiefs of Staff took action almost immediately, I think because they simply couldn't widely distribute to their own forces the stories of how they were, in effect, leaving the wounded on the battlefield when they did not have visible injuries. So a niche partner with enormous power like Stars and Stripes or The Chronicle, or to some extent, if you want to look at it that way, like a leading metropolitan news organization around the country, and we've had many partners like that, can make a very big difference.
Tell us about your funding model, your different streams of revenue or a nonprofit organization, and as you mature as an organization, how that might be changing.
So I always say that the simplest way to sum up our business model is people give us money and we spend it. We do have some earned revenue. We sell advertising. We sell data. We've sold the film rights to some stories. We're obviously always looking for earned revenue. But it really does comprise a pretty small portion of what we do, of what we receive, and what we need to make the place go, probably less than 2%. So really, there are three big streams of revenue. One are wealthy individuals and family foundations. Second would be institutional foundations, that is to say, staffed by people whose job it is to give away other people's money. And the third would be small donors giving money mostly online at our website, and also in some cases they prefer to send checks. The largest amount of money still comes from wealthy people, but the individual donors in large numbers are catching up very quickly. I think that category will account for probably $4 million this year and will—
How big a budget?
I think we will take in probably $24 million this year.
That's fantastic.
And so that's probably become our second largest category, and I would expect it to continue to grow.
And you were very heavily reliant when you started on a single donor, but that has now spread a lot, hasn't it?
Yes. So ProPublica was started. It really was the brainchild of— originally of Herb and Marion Sandler and the Sandler Foundation in California. And it was founded by Paul Steiger, who had been the managing editor of The Wall Street Journal, my colleague there at The Wall Street Journal, and who ran our place for its first 5 years. The Sandlers were initially almost all the money. This year, they'll be something like 12 or 13% of the money. They are still our single largest donor, but it has come way down as a proportion.
Let me ask you, as an old newspaper guy, are you surprised that a nonprofit business model has worked in this arena?
Well, it depends on which me you would ask. I mean,
the guy who started this.
The guy. Well, no, but I mean the historically, which me. You know, I was in the newspaper business in the year 2000, which isn't actually all that long ago, and which, as you probably know, was the most successful year in the history of the newspaper business.
Right.
So, if you'd asked me in 2000 if I thought it. Nonprofit would succeed in investigative journalism, I would have certainly said no. But as we were indicating before, by about 2005, it was clear, and certainly by 2007 when we started, it was clear that the newspaper model was in terminal decline. I spent 15 years of my life at the Wall Street Journal. I'm a huge fan of newspapers. I still start my day with newspapers, although I read them on an iPad. But I'm very bearish about the business prospects of that model, and I think all sorts of alternatives are going to need to grow up and are growing up to fill the gaps that they are leaving.
You know, good work produced on a consistent basis is the product of a healthy corporate culture. Tell us about ProPublica's and what you and your team have done to make it a good work environment.
Well, first of all, I hope it is. You know, the boss is always the worst person to ask if someplace is a good work environment. We've had remarkably low turnover, so that's some indication, and people seem happy, so maybe they're fooling me, but that might be a good indication. I think the most important thing is being able to cycle quickly. That's critical in any digital business. Being informal, being flat, being open to maximizing the talents of every single person in the organization. I hope we're characterized by all of that. I've worked in a number of different businesses over the years. I worked in one once where my business partner, our editor-in-chief, Steve Engelberg, and I were talking about this morning, where they often had four-hour meetings. We almost never have a one-hour meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that's very important.
It sure is. You can tell a lot about the corporate culture of an organization just by their meetings. It really does tell you much. Let me close with this, Dick, and you sort of hinted at this a moment ago, but you understand this industry as well as anyone, having been the assistant publisher of the Wall Street Journal, among those other posts. Taking the state of journalism in the year 2017 in America, where do you see it going, and what do you think the future of it might look like?
I think different kinds of journalism have different futures. I think business journalism, for instance, is in pretty solid shape because people are going to pay for it. It has economic value. I think breaking news probably has economic value, and you still see that in cable television, for instance.
Everything's breaking news on cable television, it seems.
I do think that there is a need for new models to arise for some of the complex and expensive kinds of journalism. So investigative journalism, which is ours, is one. International reporting for Americans, I think, would be another, where the press – this is a subject for another day – but the press is in very significant retreat from reporting on the world for Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And state and local reporting, particularly state houses, but state and local reporting generally, particularly government reporting, I think, is also under enormous pressure. So we're just in the process of launching ProPublica Illinois, which we hope will be the first of a series of initiatives trying to help fill the gaps that I think are arising there. So I think the bottom line is different kinds of journalism have different futures. Opinion journalism, for instance, is clearly having the greatest moment in its history, and I think the low barriers to entry of digital publishing almost guarantee that for as far as the eye can see. So there's some good news, there's some bad news, and there's going to be a continuation of a lot of change.
Well, those are good insights. Richard Schoeffel, the president of ProPublica, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about that website of yours and how people can help support your work.
Well, thank you. We're at ProPublica.org. And there's a red donate button at the top right-hand corner of every page. And every contribution makes a real difference. And we very much welcome people's support.
Well, thanks, Dick. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org.
That's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And this evening, we're going over to Broad Street in Lower Manhattan to meet some of the staff at One Acre Fund. One Acre Fund serves smallholder farmers in Africa and works to help make them more productive and prosperous. We'll begin the segment with Matt Forty, their managing director and a recent guest on The Business of Giving, and then hear from members of the team.
I think some people equate nonprofits with, just good-hearted people out there delivering services. But, we really want to borrow from the best of the business world, which is really about, good professional development and training. No matter what level you're at One Acre Fund, you're probably going to be spending at our organization 30% of your time in some kind of a formal training program. It's a leadership accelerant program.
What it means first and foremost, and which you'll see in every email signature and every document that comes across your desk, is farmers first. So that means everything that we do, we're always working toward this number one goal of putting farmers first. And the values that go into that, like I said, they're kind of everywhere in the organization. But some of the main ones we talk about are humble service. So really making sure that we are meeting the farmers where they are. Most of our staff actually work in the field right alongside our farmers. Even our staff in the U.S. office get out to the field at least once a year to make sure that they have a real connection with the farmers that we are serving.
One Acre Fund really stands out in terms of feedback compared to other nonprofits I've ever worked with. It's a pretty fundamental thing to know what's expected of you and where you stand with your managers. And so One Acre Fund does a good job of creating a culture of feedback. And the main mechanism for this is the check-ins we have either each week or every other week with our managers. And it's a space where we check in on sustainability and workload, problem solve through our current projects, and also, this is key, dedicate time to big picture thinking. And that's where a lot of the innovative ideas for our teams and for organization come out of.
I thought that that broadly applies to our sort of GSD attitude, get stuff done, and then specifically how that GSD applies to input delivery. Where the GSD comes in is we have truck breakdowns, we have farmers that live in areas that, you know, just don't have access to the services that we provide, but many, many other services as well. And so when it comes to our input delivery, when we say we're going to get inputs to a farmer on a certain day, it happens. We don't call a farmer up or send a messenger to say, oh, sorry, your inputs are going to come a week from now, a month from now. They come the day that we say they're going to come, and that's how we build our trust.
And the data that we get from this really allows us to tackle different areas that may contribute to an employee's life cycle at One Acre Fund. We're able to make better decisions regarding retention, better decisions regarding work-life balance and personal sustainability, and we're able to implement new programs that really ensure that that employees are going to stay with us for a long time and have a successful career at One Acre Fund. I don't know of any other nonprofit that uses that type of data to make those decisions. And it really ensures that all of our people decisions are grounded in metrics and that we're able to assess our projects going forward.
We have four times a year people have career chats with their supervisors, either informal coffee chats, which you're reminded and encouraged to do, or a 360 review that we do twice a year as part of our annual evaluation cycle. We also have a formal mentorship program to make sure that staff members have access to mentors who they can talk to about their career challenges and their paths that might be available to them. And we also have trainings around the kind of subjects that we feel like are really important to growth, things like how to delegate efficiently, how to hire effectively, and even trainings around how you can identify what it is that you want from your own career path, either within One Acre Fund or even if that path were to take you outside. So that's something that we really feel like as we face this incredible challenge of ending poverty, we are able to make sure that people are growing and taking on as much as they possibly can.
Our team is, you know, geographically dispersed. We have people in Kenya, New York, Seattle. You know, we're kind of all over the place, and we all come together on a big conference call around a different topic every month, and we really dive deep. And everybody prepares to learn about that topic in advance. And then on the call, it's sort of like a pop quiz, you know, hey, call out someone, what would you say about XYZ? And what that does is really kind of build the culture of, hey, you need to know what you're supposed to know, sort of a thing. So I think, you know, that's a little bit unique, can be, you know, I guess high pressure at times, but it really forces you to understand, you know, the nitty gritty of what you're supposed to communicate externally.
The model is very scalable as well. We're able to move from districts and scale the same unit out within countries and to new countries. But having data around what works when we do technology trials and what our impact is also really important for getting donors and other supporters on board. And it really is this excitement from other from donors and other organizations that have enabled us to mobilize our efforts and serve so many farmers.
Our people teams in general were allowed to really dig into certain specializations. So whether it was people support or people data or recruitment. And that allowed us to establish stronger relationships with people in different departments so that we could provide better support to them. That also allowed us to really kind of flex these team building muscles. It provided me with an amazing management opportunity where I got to work with individuals on my team, with senior leaders in the organization, and really help build up our team. And then in turn, I've been able to provide that opportunity to the people who have been working with me.
And one thing that I really love about our office space is that even though we are in New York City surrounded by concrete and brick and glass, when you're in our office space, you really feel connected in many ways to the field and to the farmers that we're serving. So in every single room, there are photos of farmers who are clients of One Acre Fund working in the field with the crops that they're producing.
And I want to talk about one of my favorite rituals at One Acre Fund. So whenever I go to the field, I try to attend a farmer meeting or a field officer meeting. And one of my favorite aspects of attending these is that they always start out with a song. And often dance accompanies it too. But in every meeting I've been to, there's a song about One Acre Fund in the local language, or just a really a joyful expression of working with One Acre Fund and working with farmers. And so that's one of my favorite things about attending meetings in the field.
In addition to Matt, I want to thank all the others who participated in this segment: Jillian Joseph, Ross Morante, Dave Betts, Emily Laser, Brian Lynch, and Thea Aguiar. If you go to denverfrederick.wordpress.com, we'll have this podcast, a transcript, and pictures of the participants and One Acre Fund offices, and we'll put up a link to my full interview with Matt Forte, the managing director of One Acre Fund.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org. A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
In philanthropy, good ideas can come from anywhere. And one of the very best was hatched by a relatively modest family foundation in Minnesota, the GHR Foundation. And the idea was something called the Bridge Builder Challenge. And here to discuss it with us this evening is the Chief Executive Officer of the GHR Foundation, Amy Goldman. Good evening, Amy, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. I'm happy to be here.
Why don't we begin by having you tell us about the GHR Foundation, your mission, and the areas that you have traditionally supported?
Certainly. As you mentioned, GHR is a family foundation based in the Minneapolis area. We've actually been in existence for over 50 years in a relatively quiet way and focused primarily in the areas of education, health, and global development. Our mission is really focused on creating transformational change in the areas that we work in. A lot of this stems from our legacy. Our founders created a real estate development firm that really pioneered the concept of design build in construction and design. And we have taken that approach and applied it to how we do our giving. So with design build, we really think about how to have an integrated process, how to collaborate with partners how to be creative and not really often know what the outcome is going to be because we're constantly learning as we're working in the areas that we're investing in. So the Bridge Builder Challenge, which I'm certainly happy to talk about, really was an outcome of our thinking more directly about this inheritance that we had of the design-build approach. And so it was our opportunity to start to test some of those ideas a little bit more out in the open than we had been in the past.
Well, how was this idea conceived, and how exactly does it work, Amy?
We have several grants that we call legacy grants, which we really view as long-term partnerships with specific institutions that mean a lot to the founders of the foundation. We had one legacy grant where we were thinking we wanted to take an opportunity with that grant and that partnership to try something new. And we clearly were inspired by Pope Francis as well, calling globally to build bridges across areas. We found that very powerful. So Denver, as we were thinking about what are we going to do with this legacy grant to perhaps respond to that call of Pope Francis, while at the same time thinking about how can we open the windows at our foundation and let some fresh air in? How can we find out what those good ideas are out there? We started to think about creating a challenge. So initially, we thought with the Bridge Builder Challenge, again, that was inspired by Pope Francis. We started thinking about doing this internally and realized very quickly that we had limited capacity to do this ourselves. So we looked around for partners and ended up partnering with Open IDEO, which is the nonprofit arm of IDEO out of the Bay Area. And we're very attracted to the Open IDEO approach of human-centered design. We thought that was completely consistent with our approach at the foundation to really put people at the center of all of our goals for our programs. So we started our partnership with Open IDEO, and frankly, it was a bit of an experiment and a stretch, I think, for both of us. I will certainly talk for GHR Foundation. Open IDEO had not issued a challenge with a private foundation before. So we were learning as we went, but also, as I mentioned, learning in the open in a very transparent way. And I'd be happy to discuss more details of that if you're interested, but that's the basic outline of how we landed on the Bridge Builder Challenge concept about a year ago at this time.
And the three pillars of the Bridge Builder concept were peace, prosperity, and planet. How do they intersect?
We chose those three pillars along with the fourth pillar of people because, again, it really resonated with this call from Pope Francis on building bridges across these areas. So for us, the fourth pillar of people is the human-centered design approach that we used with Open IDEO. Then with peace, prosperity, and planet, we put that in our open call globally to ask for ideas that bridged at least two or all three of those pillars because we've really seen in action the strength and the greater outcomes that can be generated by this intersection of these areas. And it really was a requirement for the ideas that came in and that surfaced that the organizations and the ideas and the people working on the ground were thinking cross-sectorally across peace, prosperity, and planet.
Yeah, and that's quite distinctive from other philanthropic challenges and prizes, right?
We have found it to be, and I think it is demonstrated by the fact that we had such an enthusiastic response beyond our wildest expectations. So we weren't quite sure how unique it was, and we were testing it, and we certainly think it confirms this uniqueness, again, to bridge across these areas.
Well, speaking about submissions, how many people submitted ideas in the initial Bridge Builder Challenge?
Well, it's a little hard to believe now, but at the time when we were doing our risk assessment around launching the Bridge Builder Challenge, one of our biggest worries was, would we get enough responses? We ended up getting over 662 responses.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it just absolutely astonished us. And also we had engagement with the challenge in 185 countries.
That is really quite impressive. And when people, you know, when people put forth their submissions, you posted them online, correct?
Yes. Everything was online, learning in the open. So the ideas would come in. They would be online on the Bridge Builder platform. They're still there. We're keeping that platform live. And I encourage anyone to go visit it to see the scope and the diversity of ideas. And then the process itself was also online as we went through feedback. Essentially, the ideas would come in and there would be feedback then from the beneficiaries of these ideas. So it was an opportunity for the ideas to go back to their own communities and refine and get input on the ideas. And then we had a next stage, which was an expert feedback area. So we really contacted and were very grateful for interaction from a large group of experts in the various areas where the ideas came in, and they would give feedback, again, all on the platform. So part of, there are many aspects to this that really we are testing, but one aspect is that this process be beneficial to all the ideas that are submitted. So with this transparency and learning in the open, the ideas themselves could be refined whether or not they end up being the awardees from GHR Foundation. It's also an opportunity to attract additional funding from, you know, other foundations, but also just the general public. And when I say that, I mean globally, because we've had so much engagement from countries around the world.
Just a fascinating process, Amy. Well, you recently announced the top five ideas of this inaugural challenge. Share with our listeners a couple of them.
We have five ideas, as you said, you know, choosing among your children. They are all exciting and wonderful, and we are really looking forward to working together with this cohort of ideas. I would highlight two. One, just very briefly, because it hits on all three of Peace, Prosperity, and Planet, the bridges, and it's a project to promote ethical gold mining as a pathway to peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's a bit complicated, so I really wanted to highlight it because it really does engage across prosperity to support miners, across peace because they're former combatants, and then across planet because it is pioneering a method to have environmentally sustainable gold mining. So, but I'll bracket that and encourage everyone to go take a look at it because this other idea I think is also extremely interesting and want to be sure to highlight it, which is tree planting drones for restoring mangroves and livelihoods in Myanmar. And this is a partnership, again, at the local village level that started with seeing the devastation of the mangroves, which along the coast of Myanmar really are vital for maintaining fishing and fishing communities. So a direct link between planet and prosperity. This coming out of a local community-based response, then partnering with a firm out of the UK that is bringing the technology in to dramatically increase the amount of new trees that can be planted because of using drones. So it really, I think, is an opportunity to take a project that's already in action for the benefit of the communities, but then catapulting it in with the use of technology into planting 1 million mangroves a year. So those are two ideas I'd like to highlight, but again, encourage people to look at all five because we're very excited about all of them.
All five of them are great, but those are two great examples. Amy, how are you going to gauge the impact of the grants you've made to these five organizations?
Denver, what's great about that question is, first of all, gauging the impact is really key to how GHR does its work in all of our areas. But what's particularly interesting with the Bridge Builder Challenge is that we are experimenting and walking into some unknown territory. So our first step on gauging the impact is we're bringing the cohort of awardees together and having a workshop in October to start to really support all five of them collaboratively in what they're going to be learning across from each other across the areas that they're working in. So we are hopeful that the impact will not only, and you know, the impact that we'll really look at on the ground will not only be specific to each organization, but will also be across the cohort of organizations. So then we can look at what is the impact of bringing five diverse organizations together and giving them support. And when I say support, I mean in addition to the grant, what is the impact of that? And then in our next challenge, because we're going to be doing this again next year, what have we learned from the power of a cohort as well as the grant itself?
Blended idea. Through a challenge like this, there are always lessons to be learned, not just for the GHR Foundation, but for the field of philanthropy at large. Did any of those lessons stand out to you?
Yes, Denver, several. I would start with the open innovation process itself. This has really introduced a heightened degree of transparency to our grant making, certainly, and to social innovation in general, which we are learning from our partnership with OpenIDEO. So I would start there. In addition, for GHR Foundation, it has really helped us expand our orbit of partners and ideas and new geographies. As I mentioned earlier, we wanted to open up the windows a bit and get some fresh air into the foundation, and we certainly feel we've achieved that with the global platform and the global response that we've had. Another thing we've really learned from this is an integrated approach. We've brought in our communications, our program areas. We've really involved the entire foundation in how to structure the Bridge Builder Challenge and how to move forward with it. So that, from an internal perspective, has been a strength that I really would like to highlight, because it's a bit of an unusual approach to grant making. And I think finally, with the Bridge Builder Challenge, we are thinking of this as iterative. So this is year one. We have a 3-year commitment at this point to having the process go the way it goes with OpenIDEO. So we are really anticipating that we can integrate everything that we're learning through the platform, through our partnerships, and through the ideas as we move forward and make this a richer and better process.
And we're all going to benefit from that learning. Well, Amy Goldman, the Chief Executive Officer of the GHR Foundation, I want to thank you so much for joining us this evening. For listeners who want to learn more about the foundation or those five top ideas of the Bridge Builder Challenge, where can they go to get that information?
Denver listeners can go to ghrfoundation.org. We have a link that goes directly from our website to the Bridge Builder Challenge.
Thanks very much, Amy. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Denver. Enjoyed it.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful, because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org.
It's time for Take Five, a recurring feature of the Business of Giving, with five or so quick questions posed to the leaders of the world of philanthropy, business, and social enterprise.
We are going to do Take Five with Michael Broom, the Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Are you ready, Michael?
Bring it on.
Okay. What idea in philanthropy is ready for retirement?
Not having term limits for board members.
What is your favorite documentary or movie?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
What is something really weird or unsettling that happens to you on a regular basis?
Ugliness on social media.
What is something you believe that other people think is just insane?
That climate change isn't real and that we won't benefit from a transition to clean energy.
What is the most interesting part of your morning ritual?
Most interesting and most enjoyable is breakfast with my kids.
What is something that you purchased that you've gotten your money back on 100 times over?
I would say my backpack.
What have you changed your mind about in the last 10 years and why?
I may be changing my mind on whether my kids should get a dog.
If you were a kitchen utensil, what would you be?
I would be a ladle.
If you could start your career all over again and do something completely different and away from this field, what would that be?
I would write.
What superpower would you like to have?
To be able to travel through time.
If you could have one gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, what would it say?
Believe.
What one book would you give as a gift?
Sapiens.
What topic would you speak about if you were asked to give a TED Talk on something completely outside your main area of expertise?
How to manage a little league team and have fun doing it.
Given the choice of anyone in the world, dead or alive, who you could have over as a dinner guest, who would you invite?
I would invite my father before he came down with Alzheimer's.
What advice would you give to your 25-year-old self?
Learn how to dance.
And finally, do you have a quote you live by or think of often?
Gandhi said that the difference between what we do and what we're capable of doing would suffice to solve most of the world's problems.
Thanks, Michael. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
And that is this week's show. The NFL season kicks off next Sunday, so this broadcast will be preempted by a football game. In fact, that'll be the case for the next several Sundays. But the show is still there on live stream, so go to the AM 970 website and listen to it there. And we have some wonderful guests coming up in the month or two ahead, including Gary Nell, the CEO of National Geographic, and Deborah Rutter, president of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I look forward to having you back here again for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.